Welcome back, everyone, and thanks for staying with us. It is a very great pleasure to introduce our third speaker for this morning. Beside me is the Honourable Kelly Vincent, MLC, who has a number of firsts to her name. We sort of, in the disability community, we don't use the word inspirational. It's a bit of a vomit word for us, but Kelly has a number of firsts. She was the youngest woman ever elected to an Australian Parliament, the first to be elected on a disability rights platform, and is the leader of Dignity for Disability in the South Australian Legislative Council. First elected in 2010, Kelly champions many issues. Her work led to the establishment of the South Australian Disability Justice Plan, and among her many other achievements, she recently established a committee to inquire into the educational experiences of students with disabilities in South Australia. Kelly's previous life was in professional playwriting and performance, and she's an active patron of the South Australian arts community. Kelly Vincent is in demand as a speaker and has spoken at conferences interstate and overseas, and she appears regularly in the media. On a daily basis, through her work as a parliamentarian, Kelly Vincent is contacted by people in crisis, often due in part to the disproportionate amount of time people with disabilities have to spend battling bureaucracy simply to gain the fair access that others will take for granted. Kelly says her goal, an admirable one for politicians, is to make herself redundant, and she says this goal will be realised when having a disability in Australia no longer constitutes a full-time job. Kelly Vincent is a prominent and respected advocate for people with disabilities in the South Australian political landscape. She supports radical change in the way the needs of people with disabilities are met, believing that attitudinal change is the key. We're fortunate to have her today. Please make her very welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Greg. How's the South is for volume? Because I do have one of the most pathetic voices known to humankind, and it is a bit of a sensitive point for me, so just let me know if you need me to amp it up a bit, and I'll do what I can. As has been said, my name is Kelly Vincent, and I represent the Dignity for Disability Party in the South Australian Upper House of Parliament. I have been in that role for 5 years now, and I wanted to just give you a brief, very brief background about some of the work that we do before I leave into mostly talking about the Disability Justice Plan, which Craig mentioned. So since being elected to Parliament, I have been frankly inundated by constituents, both with and without disabilities, but mostly with. Again, mostly due to the fact that this is a sector and a community that's been under-responded to and under-resourced and under-supported for many decades now. However, I should add that while I have a focus on disability rights, as an Upper House MP, my work covers all portfolio areas, and I think this is important for many reasons, not least of which is that it helps to stop perpetuating the idea that people with disabilities are only interested in issues that have the word disability in their title. So for all of us, as change makers, policy leaders who are driving the future, we need to ask ourselves, how do we enable all people, including those with disabilities, to have a voice? I am passionate about advocating that so many of the barriers that we as people with disabilities face are no longer inherent, only existing because we have a disability. To me it is clear, and I think probably to everyone in this room, that in fact these barriers are not intrinsic. They are the result of a community or a society that is ignorant and has failed to keep up or cater to the diversity of need that already exists within it. Today, as we meet to discuss the justice system, I wanted to briefly share a few case studies from my constituent files that illustrate some of the problems. There's a woman with intellectual disability who has basic literacy skills, communicates only with some sign language, who's never been educated about sexual, emotional and physical abuse, and who has challenging behaviours, or so-called challenging behaviours, as a consequence of long-term abuse in a residential home. The information that was eventually given to her about abuse did not take into account her literacy levels and therefore was inaccessible to her. A deaf woman whose primary language is Auslan, Australian Sign Language, is in a partnership with a physically and emotionally violent man who is also deaf. The strong sense of cultural pride within her deaf community and the lack of accessible services, such as knowing how to interact with the National Relay Service or an Auslan interpreter, prevents her from taking action to leave her situation. A blind woman, who is assisted by a guide dog, finds it difficult to find refuge from her partner violence that's taking place in her home because she's told she can't take her guide dog to her local shelter and therefore can't escape her situation. These are unfortunately just a few of the cases I could share. When it comes to disability, and women with disability in particular, I continue to be shocked by and angered about the fact that so many of these needs are not taken into account. Women with Disability Australia estimates that as many as 90% of women with intellectual disabilities specifically have experienced physical or sexual violence in their lifetime, and 68% of those will experience that abuse before the age of 18. We have to look at the personal, family, and community cost of this abuse, and on the positive side, see how society at large will benefit once justice is achieved. Providing people with disabilities with the education, knowledge, and tools to recognise and speak out about abuse is key, and this has already been touched on very eloquently by some previous speakers. Many people with disabilities, it seems, miss out on basic things like sex education in schools. I myself was one of them. And one reason for this might be because it is often a part of the physical education curriculum, in which a student may not participate because of physical disability. The other part of the issue, though, and the much broader problem, is that people with disabilities are often consciously and unconsciously judged as sexually undesirable or unwanted, or were infantilized. It is assumed that we do not have the capacity to learn about these issues or to engage in these types of relationships, that is, romantic and or sexual relationships. Often, from my observation, this happens because of a false notion that denying people access to this information and these resources keeps us safe. But when we deny people the basic right to education about healthy interpersonal relationships, whether they be sexual or romantic relationships or not, we do not keep people safe. Quite the opposite is true. Not only does this denial of education deny us the dignity of risk and a variety of human experiences that for any other person would be considered normal and natural, it also exposes us to unnecessary harm. Because if we don't have because not having the ability or the knowledge to navigate these relationships does not take away our desire to enter into them. All it does is minimise our ability to enter into them safely. I mentioned just a few minutes ago some statistics which clearly indicate that women and girls, particularly with disabilities, are more likely to experience physical and sexual violence. And I'm willing to bet that one of the reasons for this, at least in part, is that perpetrators will deliberately target a victim who is likely to be disenfranchised and disempowered, and who may not have the tools, including education and communication supports, to recognise wrongs and speak out about them. I want to touch very briefly on another case that illustrates this. And it is a case, I will preface this, it is a case I've heard of third hand and from a few years ago, but I still think it is very relevant. A disability service provider facilitating a group home where the residents all had some level of intellectual disability recognised that these residents were starting to get into relationships either with other people their age or with other residents. Because they wanted to respect this, they brought in a sexual health service to teach the residents about sexual health and personal safety. The residents were shown how to put on a condom on the end of a broomstick. A few mornings later, a personal attendant came into one of the residents' bedrooms to assist one of the residents with personal care and found two of the residents naked in bed together with two broomsticks with condoms on the end of them, one at each side of the bed. These residents obviously believed they had practiced safe sex. So not only is it a massive a hurdle trying to get access to this information, access to information that is accessible and takes into account the fact that different people learn differently is another challenge. And this could be for many reasons, not just disability, but for cultural considerations as well. We need to do away with the assumption of prior knowledge just as much as we need to do away with the assumption of incapacity. During the hearings of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse, there are, of course, horrific and painful reminders of the cruelty of human against human, particularly adults against children, and we've heard one of those today. These cases strike us at our core, and it may seem that there is no respite from perpetrators of such offences. But it is beholden on us to continue to push for the reforms that we know will make a difference in access to justice for all. The barriers to justice for people with disabilities are not only those aspects of the legal system which have historically made it difficult or impossible for us to fully participate in it, and I will touch on those shortly. Through the work of many in the community, we have seen considerable progress and certainly an increase in awareness since I first held a specific forum on barriers to the justice system for people with disabilities in 2011. Dignity for Disability has worked hard to achieve change in the way that people with disabilities are treated in our justice system, in South Australia specifically. And we hope that this goes some way to preventing violence as a deterrent. Legislation that forms part of the Disability Justice Plan under the Vulnerable Witnesses Bill 2015 has been endorsed by the South Australian Parliament. We hope that it will transform the experience of people with disabilities, and it is an example of what policy and law reform needs to look like, because it includes, through hefty consultation, the voices of people with disabilities to help create a paradigm shift. So I'd like to go through some of the changes that have now been put into legislation through the South Australian Justice Plan. Firstly, it allows for communication assistance, sometimes called communication partners, for people who need it, in either a police or court interview, particularly a court interview. This might be a witness, either a defendant or an alleged victim, with a disability that impacts communication and or cognitive recognition, or a person who, for any other reason, uses an augmentative or alternative communication method. For example, this could be assisting to gather evidence from a person who communicates using a communication board or a type of sign language. It means that a person who might need a speech pathologist or other trained professional to support them in court will also be able to access them as an independent communication partner, and that person will help facilitate the conversation between the witness and the judge, for example. The bill also allows for ground rules hearings, which set out things like what is admissible evidence and what type of questions can be asked of so-called vulnerable witnesses, such as disallowing the use of verbose or convoluted questioning, which may be used to deliberately confuse a victim with lower literacy levels or particular communication needs. The new laws also provide for the use of audiovisual recordings of interviews as the evidence of victims or witnesses who are either children aged 14 or under, or who have a disability that may affect their ability to give evidence in a court in cases involving violence, particularly sexual violence, and how those interviews are to be conducted. Hopefully this will ensure that more cases are in fact prosecuted. And we certainly heard from the evidence from Wild that there is a need for more of that to occur. The bill also allows for the use of so-called hearsay evidence in restricted circumstances. For example, a teacher, parent or other caregiver will be able to report in a court what a person with disability has disclosed to them if the person may not be able to disclose it themselves. As an example of the type of restricted circumstance where this might be used, I'm aware of a case where seven children with varying intellectual and communication disabilities were allegedly sexually abused by their school bus driver. this case never proceeded to trial. One morning, one of the young boys went into the classroom, pulled his teacher aside, pulled down his pants, pointed to his genitalia, said the bus driver's name and the word ouch. This may be an example of the kind of thing that would be included. The laws also extend the priority listing of trials to include people with disabilities where the disability affects memory, so that the trial must go ahead 3 days, no more than 3 months after original arrangement. This is to allow as much evidence to be gathered as possible. There have also been amendments to the Evidence Act to allow for an exemption for the need to give evidence in a court. Again, this is hopeful that it will protect people who may be feeling particularly traumatised. I'm very proud to have been associated with these law reforms, but still many more cultural and policy changes are needed, such as the need for education, which I touched on earlier. Too often, people with disabilities attempt to report or disclose crimes being perpetrated against them, and they are not believed, and no investigation is undertaken. To improve this, at least in part, you need a well-trained and understanding first point of contact when a crime is reported. To this end, Dignity for Disability continues to lobby for police and other investigative agencies to implement compulsory and comprehensive training in recognising and responding to disability-related needs. Additionally, we need the police to also have specialist trained officers at a higher level so that they can conduct interviews meaningfully and respectfully with people with specific needs using appropriate questioning methods and allowing for the use of communication aids when necessary. Statistics show, of course, that women with disability in particular, or people with disability, are also overrepresented in prisons. Particularly women who have been victims of violence in their early years are more likely to end up on the wrong side of the justice system. And I know that to this end there is some interest in investigating the need for a specialist disability forensic unit. I'm not sure how I'm going for time. Okay. So I certainly don't underestimate the enormity of the task that still lies before us. And of course it can at times be overwhelming, but I do believe that forums such as today enable us to gather the strength and, dare I say, the inspiration to move forward from learning from each other. And I'd like to end with a quote that I think illustrates this, the need for this change. And the quote is this: "Where, after all, do human rights begin? In small places, close to home, so close and so small that they cannot be seen on any maps of the world. Yet they are the world to the individual person. The neighbourhood they live in, the school or college they attend, the factory, farm or office where they work. Such are the places where every person seeks equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity, without discrimination. Unless these rights have meaning in these places, they have little meaning anywhere. Without concerted citizen action to uphold them close to home, we look in vain for progress in the larger world." These are the words from Eleanor Roosevelt, so they are somewhat dated, but unfortunately, they still ring true today. Here in Australia in 2015, we have come a long way in recognising the need to break down the barriers and the part that we can all play in that. So I encourage you all to continue this conversation and to play whatever part you can in that change. Thank you.
So we've got about 10 minutes for questions for Kelly. So I just see the first one's got one is right down the back there.
Thank you very much. That was very, very interesting and informative. My name is Sonia Valencia from ADCAS, ACT Disability Asian Carers Advocacy Service. My question was, you were speaking about sex education being given to people with disabilities, and in your opinion, would that best be given by people themselves who have disabilities?
I think that's an interesting question, and probably one that would need broader consultation than just my opinion. But I think that there are two parts to that question. One is about the recognition of the right to have access to this information, and to get into that class in the first place. So I think there is need for greater education within general teachers and so on. But that's an interesting question about whether, I think one of the big challenges that we face as people with disabilities is that even if we do get access to that education, as with many things, not just sex ed, but the fashion industry, role models, actors, you know, being portrayed in the media, they're not necessarily portrayals that will fit in with our lives. So maybe there is a need for peer education as well, and I'd like to look into that. I'd be interested if there are any programs where that's happening. I'd like to know. But I think there needs to be a two-pronged approach, and maybe, you know, teachers could work in collaboration with people with disabilities in doing this education, because, you know, I'd hate for that to go the other way, where just because somebody locks up in a wheelchair, for example, to the class, they suddenly get sent over to the disability corner, where they should, of course, also have access to that education in the classroom with other students. So I think there's a balance to be struck there.
Question just about three rows back.
Mary Nolan from DANA, Disability Advocacy Network. Kelly, just following up on the last question, actually, there has been a review program called Living Safer Sexual Lives. It was developed by Patsy Crawley and was rolled out in Victoria, certainly, and to a small extent in Tasmania. I know there's been one or two goals of it in New South Wales, but I don't think there's any current funding for that program. But what it is a peer education program by women with intellectual disability presenting to other women with intellectual disability about sexual education. It's a really good program, but I think lack of funding has stopped it at the moment.
Thank you. Now that you've mentioned it, it has actually rung a bell, but I will look into it further. Thank you.
In terms of the police force, do you actually think that what we're needing is something like the LGBTI contact officers that they have in police forces? And that kind of gives rise to the question, why don't we have, do we have police officers with a disability?
That's a very interesting question. I, off the top of my head, I can't think of whether there are any people with disabilities in the South Australian Police Force. Having said that, I don't know the entire South Australian Police Force. I live far too boring and safe a life to be acquainted with the entire police force, but I'm working on it. But that's not to say that they're not there. But again, I think, you know, you raise a valid point about representation and about how safe you're going to feel when your experiences are maybe not understood as deeply as they might be if there were. So I'll make sure I look into that further. But I think you're right in terms of what we should look at is a point of contact where there is a point of deeper recognition of the need. And one of the things that certainly frustrates me is when we first started working on this, I met with the police force and in South Australia, they were quite convinced that, you know, everything was fine because, you know, all police officers, all frontline police officers do a communication course online. Now, I'm Generation Y, but I would still argue that nobody learns to communicate properly online, let alone considering all the nuances that can come along with disability-related communication needs. So I think one barrier we face is actually trying to get those antiquated institutions to recognise that they don't actually know all the answers, and I think Kobe touched on that very well in her presentation too.
Thanks. Kobe, you've got a question.
Hi, Kobe here. With the police force and all that, you're saying that you're trying to change the ways of how they're going to be dealing with disability people. How can you manage to change that? Like, are you going off on more training? Are you going off on support around people with disabilities? Like, because if they don't have advocates like I do, or they can't raise their health through wild or through any sexual assault people, and they need to go into an older unmarried. How are you going to manage to cover all that basis?
Yeah, it's a good question. Thanks, Kobe. Some of the changes which I mentioned in my presentation are already in law, so I've done it through a change to the law in terms of access to the courts. In terms of for the police system, we've been lobbying very hard and we're still lobbying very hard, meeting with the police, talking about what kind of things they need to put in place, like more training about disability and how that might affect the way someone needs to be communicated with or spoken to. But it is an ongoing process. We've been working on this disability justice plan for 5 years. And it's a very long process because, as I'm sure you know, Kobe, the police sometimes are very stuck in the way they do things. So we just have to keep pushing and pushing. And I think using examples of stories like yours and other stories that we're hearing is really important, because sometimes if the police don't hear those stories, it's easier for them to say, oh, everything's fine, because they don't see the problem. So I think we need to keep pushing and sharing these stories so that it gets in their face and they can't pretend there isn't a problem anymore.
With that, why don't we try and involve the police in one of these meetings and conferences? Like, if someone from the police can attend one of the hearings, but they can turn around and say, right, okay, we might have to try and help our colleagues change the point of views on the same person. Because I've been there, I know it's a very touching thing being a disabled person.
Yeah.
Someone with a disability, with slight development delay, and all that kind of stuff. Like, I've got intellectual disability, and it's very touching walking up to a police officer who don't want to listen to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can.
We could offer, or one of you guys could offer someone from Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, wherever, to try and, show them the way of.
Yeah.
I'll let Kelly briefly respond to that, but I think that's probably not as much a question for our team at PWD Australia as that is for Kelly.
Do you know that's exactly what I was going to say? I was going to say that we in the Dignity for Disability Party in South Australia have been working directly with the police, but I think it would be up to these guys to try and organise the police come to these forums. But I think that's a great idea, and thank you for raising it.
I think it's a great idea too. We've got people from the Royal Commission project who are tapping away all of the good ideas that are coming out of today's forum, and if that's not already happening, I'm sure that will be on the agenda for future. Have we got other questions?
Speaking of people from the Royal Commission. Hi, Kelly Domina from the Royal Commission. I just wanted to ask a question, because obviously you guys in South Australia are ahead of the game with the Disability Justice Plan. So I wanted to ask, from a broader national perspective, firstly, how's it being received, how's it progressing, but also how is that being shared with other jurisdictions, because we're looking at it from a national perspective and keen to tap into, I guess, what's already happening when we look at how we make our recommendations as well.
Yeah, look, I think Davina, you've hit the nail on the head, and national approach is absolutely key, because unfortunately we'd be naive to believe that this kind of abuse only happened in South Australia. In fact, we know just from today that that's not the case. And we've certainly, I mean, I guess I have to preface this by saying that my role is as a state MP, and there's only so much I can do, but we've certainly been very active together with people like People with Disability Australia, and pushing for a national approach. And interestingly, the Human Rights Commission on a national level in the Equal Before the Law report, which was mentioned, I think, by a previous speaker, does name South Australia as a bit of a leader in terms of introducing comprehensive policy change around this. And so, all I can say is that we'll continue to take every opportunity. And, I've done a lot of national media on this, and so we'll use any forum available to push for that national approach, and I guess that's the only response I can give you at this point.
We've probably got room for one more question.
But stretching it. If not, then I just want to end off with a quick question for Kellidge. Politicians usually measure something like the justice plan in terms of evidence and outcomes. In thinking about the justice plan, what sort of outcome are you actually looking for? Is it an increase in prosecutions? Is it an actual decrease in the underlying incidence of abuse? How will you measure success, and how can we prosecute this with other jurisdictions?
It's an excellent question. I think that really it's all of those things and more. I think really, though, the brief answer would be when it is no longer a novelty to see one of these cases proceed to trial, because that's, I think, the crux of the issue at the moment, is that any case that is getting anywhere close to going to trial is, you know, I think part of the reason that it gets so much media is that it's so novel, because we're still learning how to use these communication methods and questionings and so on. And so I think over time, as it becomes normalised, that will be the measure of success. But I think it's all of those things, from education about safety to prevent abuse, hopefully, and all that choice and control, to prosecutions in the event that abuse does occur.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Kelly Vincent for her work on this.